coming to you live from election headquarters. This is Everything But the Election with Ask Me Anything with Enrique and Dave on this special episode of Sales Burrito. So stay tuned and we're getting to your questions coming up next.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time! Welcome to Sales Burrito! The premier podcast for today's sales engineers working in technology sales, created by SEs for SEs, with your hosts, Enrique Barreto and Dave Siles.
Well, for being your first intro, it was pretty cool, man. I like it.
You know, off the cuff, man. You know, when you're doing a hot take special, you got to do it. You got to do it right. How you doing, buddy?
Man, I'm doing very good. I'm doing very good. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. You know, we're almost a dozen episodes in, and you know, one of the benefits of having your own podcast is that you can call an audible every once in a while. And you know, this week is probably one of the more interesting weeks in the world. So we're going to talk about everything but the election. And we've been getting questions from our audience, you know, throughout our social media channels. And we figured, what's a better opportunity to take, you know, take a pause, look at some of these questions, and really take the opportunity to address these questions that have come our way. So tonight we're going to give you, you know, live and in living color, the Ask Me Anything edition of Sales Burrito with Enrique and Dave.
This can go different ways. I mean, to your point, right? You know, our audience has been sending us some of this stuff. Some of these questions are, I mean, I get it. Okay. Some of them are like, well, why are they even asking this? Right. But you know, what's good about it is that both you, but yourself and myself have been through a lot of experiences and lifelong lessons of being a sales engineer. So when we review the questions, at least these 10 questions that we reviewed, we're like, okay, we can go with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a fair ask, right? I mean, some of these questions, I think, you know, when we look at it on paper saying, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people would ask those, because I had those same questions when I was becoming an engineer. You know, and then some of them I thought were really good questions. You know, some of them I think we may have to change the names to protect the guilty or the innocent, but, you know, fair questions, fair ask. So, you know, I think we dive right into it, you know, from that top down there. If you wanted to take the first one there and fire my way, I'm happy to step up to the plate first.
Well, listen, this is the Ask Me Anything session of Sales Burrito. Question number one. You ready? Here we go. Dave, walk me through the worst firing of a sales engineer that you have personally done and that it hurt you.
Ooh. Well, obviously, you know, once you get into management, you do obviously go through the cycle of hiring and unfortunately firing. But, you know, there have been those few that just kind of stick out. I think the worst one had to be, though, one of the earlier ones in my career where, you know, you hired a friend. And sometimes, you know, the friend side of the equation isn't necessarily the best skill set to acquire when you're looking at the engineer as a whole. And so having to make that realistic, you know, determination that, you know, I brought a friend in that just wasn't cutting it, and having to let that friend go and try to do it in a way that I knew was going to impact him, but at the same time was probably the right thing to do for him and for the company. Yeah. And to this day, you know, looking back on it, we're still friends and we've had conversations about it. It was a rough patch at the time, but hurt me personally. You know, I wore it on my sleeve for a while. I felt like I failed that engineer. And, but you know, hindsight 2020, you know, we've had conversations about it now, you know, years later. And he's actually told me, you know, it's one of the better things you've done for me in my career, because, you know, I needed the wake up call. And, you know, he's not necessarily in the sales side of the world anymore, still in the technology field, but you know, it's kind of just, you know, realizing that, you know, sales engineering is not for everybody. But that one hurt. You know, it's like, you know, that personal relationship, it's you can't disconnect the personal dynamic sometimes from, you know, the business side of it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I would say that the problem with the question for me is that I've had one situation where I made a, you know, it's not that I made a bad judgment call, but I believed in one person that I created a good relationship with, and it just didn't work out, right? And mutually we agreed, you know, hey, it's time to go. I will say the worst firing, you know, and I will tell you that it did not hurt me, and I'm going to go on the record and say that it did not hurt me, was an SE that I had in Atlanta one time where, you know, at the time, you know, I've lived in Tampa for as long as I can remember, and this sales engineer, for some crazy reason, could not be on appointments, anytime before 10 a.m. So, you know, the sales rep starts talking to me about it. The sales manager starts talking to me about it. Everybody's able to attend these meetings, but this gentleman can't. And obviously, the first thing you think, the first emotional thing you think is, what's wrong with this person, right? But, you know, how come you can do it? You need to do it. So what it ended up being is, as I started looking at different things, is that this individual owned 3 car washes. And,
oh, geez.
And because he owned 3 car washes, he needed to open the car wash, have the cash ready for the cashiers, have the crews ready with the soap, the water, all that kind of stuff, so that then after that, he could do work. Now, I don't have anything against someone owning a business on the side and doing something else. So as long as that doesn't compromise the responsibilities of what I've hired that individual. And in this case, blatantly, it was affecting that. So that is, you know, that was one of the worst firings, because I was too young as an SE manager. I just couldn't believe it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think it's always a double-edged sword when conflict there. You know, obviously, I think some businesses are okay with it. And there's some companies that just say, hey, look, no, you can't do it. And it's just got to be a board up front. So I can see where, you know, you'd be in that situation. But, you know, I think mine hurt probably a little bit more than yours did there. But
yeah, no, absolutely. All right, your turn.
Yeah.
Ask me a question.
Next question, you know, I'm not surprised to get this, because I think it's one of the things that most new engineers, and some even some existing engineers, you know, when they're looking at jobs and opportunities, understanding the OTE side of the equation, right? You know, what I would call OTE mathematics, you know, how do you deal with, you know, the risk side of your variable and the salary, negotiating for it, you know, what kind of upside should you be asking for? What kind of risk should you take? What's your take on that?
You know, to me, at the first time that I heard the term OT, you know, when my first SE manager was explaining to me that, to me, it looked like voodoo economics. That's what it looked to me. I was like, how is that possible? How does this work? Because, you know, when I was an IT manager, I was, you know, you get compensated a fixed rate every 2 weeks. So you're compensated all the time, the same fixed rate, until you get a salary increase. But then all of a sudden, somebody's talking to you about this OTE, or the on-time earnings, right? And they say, well, your OT is, I don't know, let me pick an OT that is simple. Your OTE is $100,000 on a 70-30. So at the beginning, I didn't comprehend what that meant. You know, so when I would ask what my salary is, it was, well, your salary is $70,000. And then I'm like, okay, well, wait a minute. I'm not making that much. I'm making that now, or, you know, why would I want to go for that now if I'm making that? And everybody forgets about that 30%, right? Or the $30,000, you know, where if you do your commissions, you can get up to $30,000 on that variable. But then I've had multiple sales engineers to say, but Enrique, wait a minute. That's not guaranteed. Well, it is and it isn't, right? This is where you need to know your organization that you're going in. Certainly, you don't want to go to work as a sales engineer for an organization where your variable is zero. Because yes, you're going to make $70,000. But if you really think about it, right? Even if you were to make 50% of that 30, or the 30,000, you're still making money. And I think that that's what I often see, that new sales engineers get fixated. Is they're like, well, wait a minute, this OTE is this, but there's no way in hell that the company's not going to sell zero. So I am going, worst case scenario, if we sell 50%, which is still a bad case, you want to sell, you know, 100%, 200%, right? It's, you know, it ends up being that when you start doing the mathematics, it's a good deal. And that's the risk. That's how I typically have dealt with the risk in the past.
Yeah, I take a look at it, you know, and that kind of along the same lines, you know, it's really, honestly, it's the drug that I think people get attached to in sales, right? It's that upside. If you're truly sales driven and you are, you know, performance metric and you like to be coin operated, rewarded, you know, you understand that risk upside is your benefit for doing your job extremely well. And obviously, depending on where you're at in your career, you know, there are different rules of ideas about how risky you should take for the upside. And, you know, you get to that point where you're successful and you have a strong track record. You know, a lot of sales engineers and AEs want that highest upside as possible because, you know, they're betting on themselves. And, you know, and some companies, you know, especially on the sales engineering side, will lock that in and say, you know, an SE ratio is going to be fixed at 70, 30, 80, 20 and don't really negotiate on it. But yeah, I'm a firm believer. If you've got a track record and you believe in yourself, you know, go for the upside. But that's me and the poker player in me. But
well, very well said, right? When I, you know, I can tell you that there are some, you know, existing sales engineers that they want to do 80-20. To me, as a sales leader, when I see someone that wants to do that 80-20, that tells me this is a person that doesn't want to take a risk. And I clearly want to have somebody that wants that 60-40, that 65-35, you know, something where you know that your salary, that the bigger upside is on the, you know, like you mentioned, the drug, the variable, because that's where the real money is.
You have to balance it on where they're at in their career, though. I understand some people need that base protected for their, you know, livelihood to feel good so that they can take a job in sales and take the risk. But yeah, depending where they're at in their career, you know, I look for the same thing when I'm hiring people. If they're established and they're senior, you know, I want that hungry person that's like, hey, I'm just an absolute rock star. I'm going to knock the cover off the ball. let me go earn my upside and go for it.
Batter up, giddy up. I like it. All right.
Next pitch, my friend.
Question number three. Here we go. You ready? All right. Dave, customers that you have fired and will never, ever talk to them again, regardless of what industry you are.
Ooh.
or have you ever?
Fired customers. I've been unfortunately in that position where, you know, I've given the money back to a customer and politely asked them to never do business with the company that I was with at the time. I mean, you know, there's been different reasons for it. You know, I obviously think, you know, it's the nuclear terminal option. It's not something you go to unless it's absolutely the last resort. But when, you know, you've got a customer that, you know, in this situation happened to be very threatening and, you know, very derogatory in terms of not only to our company, but the personnel that were involved. Yeah, honestly, it was just somebody that, you know, us as a company and a business decision, we did not want to do business with. And, you know, I think that person happened to be the principal and owner of their company. So, yeah, I think if I was, you know, in a sales engagement again, it's going to pop in the back of my mind. I mean, never is a long time. And I like to think that I'm a pretty passionate person and have the right to forgive some people. But there are certain things that just once you've gone there, it's really hard to earn that trust back. So, you know, I have done it. I have fired customers. You know, flip side is I've been fired by customers as well, right? I mean, you know, sometimes you fail a customer and you don't hold up your end of the bargain on the sales side or the technology side and they fire you back. But, you know, for all the right business reasons, yes, I've fired a customer and, you know, that one person I'm thinking of, you know, actually, who obviously will not name publicly, I would have to do a serious double take whether or not I did business with them.
I, you know, well said. I think that a lot of us in the field have fired a customer. I can tell you that the, you know, I won't dwell too much on my story, but I can tell you that the only customer in the years that I've been doing this industry, it's located in Miami, and it was, I live by the rule of not tolerate. You can't tolerate what is intolerable. And kind of similar to your story, right? It was a high ranking individual with an organization that basically treated others like garbage. And it didn't matter how right or wrong I was. They did not want to take any accountability for their own consequences and actions. So one day, basically, I told my manager, I am not doing anything more here. And of course, the managers are like, well, what do you mean? It's like, what you just heard. I'm not doing it. Here's the cases. Here's the treatment that he's done. Here's all the stuff that is documented. Not doing it. And sure enough, ever since then, couldn't care less about them. Could that change? Sure. I mean, I'm a sales engineer. I'm going to be always trying to creating a solution while I, you know, get their revenue, you know, from POs and whatnot. But it left such a bad taste in my mouth that I'm like, every time I hear that company's name, I don't even stay in the business that they're in, which is travel and leisure. I don't even stay in their properties. That's how much it personally affected me.
Yeah, I get you. Well, let's see if we can brighten this up a little bit better then with...
Yeah, no kidding. It's like, Jesus.
I see a question here a little bit further down the list that came in, but I think it's a follow-on from one of our previous podcasts. But, you know, service after the sale, right, is always something we say in our industry. You know, how do you personally continue a relationship with customers after the sale?
Oh, man. It's one of my favorite questions, right? When I'm closing a deal or when I'm working an opportunity and heading to the closure of the deal, one of the things that I tell my champions or the people that I built within that account is I tell them, you know, I give them my card and I give them my cell phone number. And, you know, we could be celebrating, we could be doing different things, we could be signing on the dotted line. But what I tell them is like, look, in good times, everybody's high-fiving. Everybody's saying, oh, this is awesome, this is great. In bad times is when you're going to need me the most. And that's why I'm going to be showing my actions, because as you know, I talk a lot about this, actions speak louder than words, right? So I enjoy dealing with situations after the sale, because that truly showed the colors of my brand name. And after all, what we all have in this world is our personal brand name. And because of that, it has helped my career, you know, not by my resume, but by the word of mouth of the type of caliber of individual that I am when it comes to customers. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, question 5. Here we go. Actually, this is a good one because I've always admired you in this. You're like a Wikipedia, Encyclopedia Britannica walking all the time, okay? But how do you stay up to date with the latest developments and trends in the industry?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, for one, people who really know me know I don't sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically.
Obviously, I'm a sponge, right? I consume multiple different forms of information. I'm pretty avid consumer of RSS feeds. And if you ever logged into my personal Slack account that I have set up for myself, I've got channels dedicated to all the different topics that I'm concerned about or things that I even want to know about. If it's something that I'm just not currently dealing with and it's something I think tangentially want to know, I'll subscribe to an RSS feed and start sucking in information about it and just consume kind of the open source intelligence around it. And then really when I get into something that I really want to understand, then I start looking at, you know, kind of, especially with the emerging trend, I'll start looking at kind of who's on the tip of the wave. I read a lot of blogs from venture capitalists that I admire and who really kind of have their pulse on kind of the wave of the next curve. And, to see where they're spending their money in the early seed rounds before, you know, really kind of hits. I live in Crunchbase, you know that, and really just kind of look and see where, you know, where things are going and try to, that old adage, try to skate where the puck's going to be, not where it's at today. And so I always try to kind of stay up on one wave away. And, you know, you never can be a master of all when you're doing that. I try to have enough knowledge that so when I hear about it, it just triggers that. Yeah, I know what they're talking about and I can go into it. And then when I get on something that just really, it really intrigues me, then I start pulling on that thread and start going down the layers of the onion until I really get a good grasp of understanding it. But that's typically how I operate. It's not, yeah, I'm not a person that's going to go out and buy the book on Amazon and can see that book from, you know, book to cover to cover. It's typically more that I know how to research and read, and I'll hunt and investigate where I need to.
Yeah, we're very similar. Like I have my own RSS feeds. I mean, call me old, but that's what I do. And I subscribe to different things from RSS. But I often, you know, I will say what has helped me a lot is, to your point, and it's, again, very similar cloth. When I find something that I'm locking in, that I know that this is interesting, I'll do things like Google Trends. And then I'm starting to trend different things and articles and whatnot. And then I see, you know, who's trending more on this subject versus the other. And then once I do that is when I start kind of like deeper dive into the things, right? But it's, you know, what I find is that you have, you know, while I have subscriptions to a lot of RSS, it means nothing unless something piques your interest. And it has to pique that interest and has to question your curiosity and be able to say, this is neat. And you go in and you're diving deeper. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you catch the waves when you look at I don't read every link in the feed, right? But if I see something waving and it's something I'm not aware of, and some people start talking about it, especially the couple of the news sources that I really trust, you know, just kind of be on that leading edge. And then I start digging into it myself. So,
you know, I'm late to the game. I can tell you that I'm the first one to be late in the game, but I'm into Reddit like a lot. Like I look a lot of things there. I never knew until I really looked how much content is on Reddit.
It's the pulse of the underground. You really want an answer from people who live in the trenches. It's there, you know. It's like, you know, if you want DevOps, you know, kind of pulse of the world, go get in Stack Overflow. I mean, but yeah, those.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Stack Overflow.
Yeah. Well, flip side of that, you know, one of the things I think you're really good at in your job, and obviously you're kind of paid to be in, on top of your game here, but you know, you're amazing at competitive intelligence. And
thank you.
You know, this is probably a softball. You have to pay whoever put this question in here for you, but the question is: strategies to be a killer competitive guru at your job. And you know, this is too easy. This is a softball for you, man. You can knock cover off this one.
So it kind of leads to the last question, right? You know, for some weird reason, when I home in on a competitor, I'm on it like white on rice, man. Like I am, I don't depend on competitive teams or emerging competitive teams at organizations to get my answers. I am the guy that if I'm competing against product X, I will talk to partners. I will try to get the user guide. I will figure out, hey, someone gave me access to, you know, let's say wink, wink, access to their support portal, to be able to look at what release notes say or what problems do they have. And I'm a very big proponent that it's not about reading. I have to write it. I have to understand what is the problem and what is the issue. And then what, you know, the product that I'm sponsoring, whoever that is, how do we compete on that? And what has helped me a lot on that is that some of the stuff, well, the majority of the stuff is empirical in nature, which means that if I want to go to a prospect, let's say I have a $10 million deal and competitive is, you know, we're the underdogs and competitive is the issue. I can tell you that I can make an executive summary on the reasons why our product is better than the other product, or I can make a deep dive with paragraph sections, pages where it shows this is what it is. And it cannot be rebutted. When you tell someone, hey, this product doesn't have this, even though they're telling you that they has this, and it's on page 377, paragraph 7 of their user guide.
Yeah, you got them dead to rights. Yeah.
And basically, it's like, it's done. Game over. So I love for the opportunities to be that, see that.
you're a ninja at it, man. I love watching you operate. It's one of those things that just kind of like, it's one of those stealth skills that not everybody has. And I realize people don't like to read manuals, man, but you're deadly at it. I love it.
I mean, I will say the other thing that I do when it comes to that, man, is I don't read the manual immediately. What I do is I look for keywords. I look for warning, caution, note info, because I know that that's where I know that whoever created the manual is going to put a nugget in to make sure that the consumer doesn't fall into a trap. So when I see those warnings or the stuff that's like the, I mean, that's second nature. Like you should be going into there and then saying, aha, there's an issue here. And then from there you build.
Yeah, that's a good canary token to look for. That's great insight there. Look at that. Knowledge chips being dropped, even in an Ask Me Anything. I love it.
It's all good. All right. Question number 7. Well, and I am glad that you're answering this one because I absolutely hate this. All right, here we go. RFPs.
Uh-oh.
How to know when and when not to spend time on them.
Oh, this is easy, man. If you wrote the RFP, respond to it. If you didn't write the RFP, you're probably losing.
But it's so true. What happens is you have all these, you have all these puppy sales reps, right? And, they're wagging their tails. It's like, oh my God, we have an opportunity here. It's going to be, it's 27 petabytes of this or of that. And we have to answer the RFP. And you, when you start looking at the RFP, you're like, there's no way that we do this, right? Now, this is where sales engineering skills come in, right?
It does, yeah. And I gave you the cheat answer, but it's half true, right? I mean, you obviously you want to craft the RFP. If you really are driving the deal and you've got a champion, you should be working with that champion and coaching him. You should be drafting that RFP so that's to your strengths, even though if it's not specifically calling out your product. It should be stuff you can knock the cover the ball off of, right? You know, the only RFP that I would say, is going to be that open source RFP that you're absolutely going to have to respond to is either those large deals where it's just you have no choice, but they have a large enough team internally to actually put some thought into writing their RFP, and it's not coming from a competitor, or it's going to be one of those competitive bid situations where you're in a public sector where they have no choice but to do an RFP, and someone had to give them questions. But you have to go through it because it's the process. But really at the end of the day, if you're not leading and guiding the RFP from the outside in to your customer, you're already behind the eight ball. So you've got work to do.
I gotta give kudos to John Kerr and in his book Mastering Technical Sales. One of the things that he taught me early on was the RFP analysis one pager. And what I used to, it's a very simple Excel spreadsheet that he created. Where, you're going through different scoring, right? Is it an existing customer? Have we met with the customer prior to the RFP being released? Has the customer established an ROI expectation? So there's a lot of different things that he asks that when you start putting that into fruition, that RFP analysis one pager, it'll give you a score. And that score will kind of guide you to say, do we really want to go with or not? So what I know that sometimes you just have to answer them, but it's good to go through that exercise. And quite frankly, sometimes it's, I have sales reps and others that said, yeah, you're right. There's no reason for us to do this. Right. So I get it.
Yeah. Good old John Kerr too. We had him on our last podcast a few episodes back, so yeah, great nuggets there and love John from that perspective. So I think we're getting towards the end of the question list here, but let me throw a funner one at you. What's one of the craziest or most expensive things you've ever gotten for sales achievement or President's Club, as we like to call it here in the sales world?
I will say the craziest thing that I've gotten. It was not one thing. It was just like four things. Like the President's Club was like four or five days, and every day we got something. Like my wife got expensive jewelry from Tiffany. I got a very expensive GoPro camera. Then we got she got Ray-Ban glasses. I got Ray-Ban glasses. Like every day was something. And it culminated with a very, very nice commission bonus check, which I spent it very well.
There you go. Yeah. No, I think along the same lines, I know that the clubs that I've gone to, we're always in a fabulous location. And you know, I will say the companies, and then I've done this, and even the companies that have led, you know, where we've had president's clubs where you take care of the spouse, right? So, you know, whatever I've gotten materially, it meant to me, it was 10 times more to get something, you know, for my wife and have her, you know, be taken care of and pampered. And you just realize it's kind of her reward for giving me up, you know, throughout the entire year and having the chance to kind of recognize. And so if that's really valuable, almost priceless to me was the fact that, you know, that she got recognized for that. And we always did something special for the spouses. You know, personally, you know, obviously the old cliche, but the Rolex watch, you know, that it's engraved that, you know, I still have sitting in the watch box. I don't necessarily wear it, but, you know, it's just kind of that pinnacle where we absolutely crushed a number. We were 350% a number that year. And, you know, it was, we absolutely knocked cover off the ball. And so, you know, they went overboard and bought everybody Rolexes and engraved it and had your number and your employee number on the back.
Jeez, that is a crush. Look at that. 350. My gosh, bro. What other questions we have? Let me see. I think, is that it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You know, and,
I think that is, that's yeah, it
for our first edition of Ask Me Anything. That was pretty insightful. Obviously, you know, we're not shy. Yeah. Obviously, if you recognize that we took these head on. So if you have questions you'd like to have us address in a future episode, by all means, throw it our way. We'll back to normal scheduled programming next week, but yeah, for closing out election night here with decision indecision, not talking about politics at all. Yeah. This has been a special episode of Sales Burrito with Enrique and Dave. As always, we drop pop episodes weekly on all your favorite podcast platforms. You can follow us on social media at Sales Burrito. And until next time, as my friend would say,
keeps the chips and salsa going and the knowledge flowing.
That's right. We're out.
We hope you've enjoyed the Sales Burrito Show. To subscribe to catch future episodes wherever you catch your favorite podcast. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook at Sales Burrito. Until next time, keep the chips and salsa going and the knowledge flowing.